my editor, he is my neighbor, he is a great intellectual for helping to explain the fundamental nature of this capitalist crisis that we are in. I'm going as quickly as I can, and I'm going to turn it over to him right now. So please, if you could warmly welcome to help us bring a little understanding as well as some emotion to this brilliant, you know, brilliant day, Victor Wallace.
I hope I can live up to that marvelous introduction. It's an enormous honor to speak here with the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture. I was a great admirer of Howard, had an opportunity to host him at my institutions on two different occasions, and he's a terrific example for all of us. So I hope you all read.
Can you scream?
They're taking this from us
for the march.
So I'll have to.
Okay. You guys move on in if you want. Is that?
Hey. Come on closer.
I have to. Can someone announce?
Don't mind. I'm trying to get. It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
Come on in, folks. If you want to understand this, not just march against it. We gotta pull on
in. I'll talk loud, but I can't talk that loud.
Sorry, I couldn't find it.
Okay.
Seriously.
So the plan is for me to speak for no more than about 20 minutes so that then we can have some conversation. And I've just tried to sum up some essential points. I think the great significance of this moment in history is that it shows the recognition on the part of large numbers of people, especially young people, of the systemic nature of the crisis, that it's not this or that policy, not this or that administration, but that the whole system is what is at issue. It's the whole system which systemically creates the problem. I want to go a little bit into that, and then we can get also into the question of how this might relate to any particular detailed policy demands you might make. But the crisis is, of course, of a level that hasn't been known in this country since the 1930s. It's not since then that there's been this level of unemployment, homelessness, and so on. And there are things that we can learn from the 1930s at an immediate policy level, which are quite obvious, which have not been part of the discussion. The big achievement, positive achievement of the government in the 1930s was the idea that the government could actually create jobs. The government could hire people to do useful things. Nothing of that is in the discourse that we hear today. It's all about just coaxing, cajoling the private sector to somehow come into play and do its thing, which it systematically doesn't do. It won't do it. So, and to those who say that government is inherently inefficient, I would simply mention one of the outcomes of the 1930s, which is the Social Security system, which is one of the most efficient, that is to say, lowest percentage of overhead for the amount of turnover that it has of any service. So it is a great example. It can be done, and the government type of useful employment is something that hires many more people for the amount of investment that it requires. Anyway, however, despite all those, we have to recognize those achievements, but we also have to recognize the insufficiency, the shortfall of that whole period. Because the point was, they didn't take power away from capital, finally. It was limited slightly because of the strength of the popular movements, but it wasn't taken away. And what does that mean? Eventually, bit by bit, they're going to take it back. And that's what they've been doing, really, in the last 30, 40 years especially. And this is really come into high gear. It goes back to the 1970s, and I think the best analysis that you can get of this is in a videotape one-hour lecture by Professor Rick Wolf. How many of you have seen that? It's called Capitalism Hits the Fan. You can just look that up, Capitalism Hits the Fan, on the internet. In brief, what he points out in that lecture, but with much more detail and a very lively presentation, is that starting in the early 1970s, what had been the case, the kind of truce between capital and labor, whereby as productivity increased, so also did wages, that was broken by capital. They launched a kind of class war against labor, no more wage increases. Essentially, wages stagnated since that time, whereas capital continued to flow in. You had this huge concentration just of liquid wealth, which gave birth to the whole financialization, speculation, all the phenomena that we see that culminated in the bubble that led to the crash of 2008. So check out Rick Wolf on that. Now, the thing I want to say in terms of all the arguments about this movement, that the fact that we point at a critique of the system as a whole doesn't mean that we are not interested in particular demands. But what we do have to insist is that the working out of those demands, the formulation of them, has to be carried out within the framework of an understanding of the systemic nature of the problem. And given that understanding, our long-term goal is to actually achieve a shift of class power. The short-term goal, well, it's not that short-term, it's still a long thing, is to build a popular movement, to increase the scope and the presence and the independence of the popular movement so that it can culminate eventually in a political organization that would have the capacity to rule. In other words, to take power away from the 1%. You're not going to take power away from the 1% or the 0.1% just by proposing reforms. They won't give them. I heard what Jeffrey Sachs was saying, the corporations shouldn't be running the government. Well, the corporations will inevitably try to run the government. That's what they have to do in order to function. So the power has to be taken away from them altogether. But it can't be done all at once. But the movement has to be animated by the awareness that that's what's ultimately necessary. And that's the question. Can we develop a movement that goes far beyond what was done in the 1930s? So regarding capitalism in general, this rich get richer, poor get poorer phenomenon is built into capitalism. It's been there all along. There have been periods and moments in particular countries, even in this country at certain times, where that polarization has been offset, has been reduced. But it always comes back. They always try to bring it back. In that sense, that the class conflict is continual. And anyone who says that by protesting that we're initiating class warfare overlooks the fact that class warfare goes on all the time anyway. It's just a question of what is the relative strength of the opposed parties. And certainly the difference between rich and poor globally has increased dramatically over time. And nowadays, it's increasing sharply within the more advanced countries. Some of the factors in this, sort of bringing about this present crisis, apart from what Wolf points out about the concentration, the financialization, I think the end of the what I call the first epoch socialism, the collapse of the imperfect, but let's say, in retrospect, experimental regimes of the first 70 years since the Russian Revolution left capital with a seemingly clear field, what was called the end of history, the idea that there was no alternative. That was the famous phrase of Margaret Thatcher. Well, that was important, not because those regimes were any great models, but because their very presence forced capital, or its political representatives, to recognize that they would need to make concessions to accept progressive social reforms in order not to have, in order for them not to be displaced or thrown out. Now they think they can do anything. They can get away with anything. They can bomb any country at will and so on. And they don't have to worry about what people think they can. And so you get this sort of untrammeled aggressiveness domestically, where they're busting unions. And of course, we had the Wisconsin president as a reaction against that, which has inspired our movement now. They're busting unions. And even now, as you may have read in the last few weeks, all these states are introducing measures to take away the right to vote from poor people. Of course, they dress that up under slogans like, well, having an ID or redesigning districts or not voting on Sunday or this, that, or the other. But it's basically aimed against poor people. And it's been calculated that the restriction of the franchise could affect as many as 5 million people. So it's becoming much more aggressive. And this is one of the immediate factors that's also stimulated the growth of this movement. The point is then, where was I? So the representatives of capital, they're sort of going all out in pursuit of their immediate interests, and of course, as a result, they end up provoking popular outrage, which finally is beginning to take a kind of clear form of recognizing the underlying causes. And so this was the problem. The early reactions against it, which were heavily funded and stimulated and encouraged by the right wing, they'd look at superficial manifestations of one kind or another, like the an inadequate health care bill and so on, and demonize that, and call it all kinds of names and so on. But now we're actually raising the question of where the power in the society lies and what the real causes of the underlying problems are. And the problem we have to recognize, and that everybody has recognized in terms of their immediate political practice, is that the Democrats are at the leadership level. I'm not saying every single Democratic politician, but at the leadership level, the Democratic Party is totally and completely bound up with capital. And the symbiosis, the sort of cooperation between the Democrats and the Republicans is absolutely it's unbreakable in a way. I felt it when I got an appeal from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee to contribute to them because of all the terrible and crazy and zany things the Tea Party was doing. And I said to myself, what would the Democrats do without the Tea Party? They love it. And that's what the media give all this attention to the Tea Party, much more than to the content of what we're doing. They only began to give attention to our movement when there was sort of police misconduct and so on. We had to sort of depend on them for that to happen. So that much, I think that with the outcome of the 2008 election, it's become much clearer to people what the Democratic Party really represents, and that it doesn't represent the kind of hope that we must have for transformation, for real change of the kind that a lot of people began to think might be possible with the election of Obama. Other factors that have come into play to help us along are, of course, the role of the alternative media. I won't go on too much about that except to recommend programs like Democracy Now! And sources locally like Open Media Boston, which is giving excellent coverage to this movement and which is a kind of forum for all kinds of discussion. And of course, the examples of people's movements around the world. So the only danger, I think, the risk, I mean, in terms of the political outcome of this process, is that the energy that's been developed here will get siphoned off into some kind of support for Democratic candidates. Whereas I think what we need to do primarily is to broaden the focus of the discussion, get it out of the realm of just sort of which candidate can be put into office, because if that's all it is, the vote doesn't make much difference. We see the change from one administration to another, and a continuity in terms of the top economic advisors, foreign policy, military, absolute continuity. So this does raise, in terms of the long-term objectives, the question of socialism. And now the interesting thing about socialism is that word has been used an incredibly increased number of times in the last few years to mischaracterize Obama. And it's extraordinary how it's been brought into the national discourse. And I think that there are many indications that the effect of this has somewhat backfired on those who have done that, because it has raised the interest in socialism. And according to surveys that were conducted now over a year ago, there's a considerable favorable disposition towards socialism, especially among younger people, 30% in the under 30 age group is having a favorable view of socialism. So another book I wanted to recommend, that's kind of one that Howard Zinn would have liked a lot, is a new one. I don't know if any of you have seen this one. I show it to you. It's worth seeing. The S Word by John Nichols. John Nichols, who is a journalist in Wisconsin, a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. The subtitle is A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism. And it goes right back to Tom Paine, Abraham Lincoln and his correspondence with Karl Marx, and many of the icons of American culture.
Really?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, you can read about it in this book. It's not to say that he agreed with it, but he was open. He read his columns in the New York Tribune. So it was so interesting things. So to finish up the basic presentation, because then we should have conversation, is that we can and must, of course, develop specific demands, but these demands always have to be developed within the context and the framework of building a movement, and not just rallying behind some candidate or other. I mean, it's one thing to have candidates who say what we like, but what we want, if we're talking about candidates, we need candidates who come up from out of our movement and who are, in that sense, by definition, accountable to us because they are of us. they're from our midst and not someone who's come down to preach to us and seek our support. I think that's what we should look for. So I think I'll stop now and we've had some conversation.
What's your name again, please?
Victor Wallace.
I totally agree with you about elections not mattering too much, but the other day we were marching partially, they said, to try to offer support for that jobs bill, which would have been better than nothing, and I know it's sort of not sufficient and not really what we're doing. Wouldn't it have, if we had Democratic majorities, it would have been a little better, right?
Yeah, I mean, one can always support particular measures, but I think, you see, the big job in building a movement is political education. And political education means explaining what a real jobs bill would do. And even a short-term thing that doesn't involve a transformation of the system, but looking at the model of the 1930s and saying, create the jobs directly. Don't try to bribe people, bribe businesses to do it. And then you can say, well, given all this and under the circumstances that people need it, all right, so we support this thing. But always have the larger age in view. As they said in the 60s, keep the eyes on the prize. I mean, that's what has to be done.
You know, here or New York, Occupy Wall Street, or elsewhere, has any candidate or candidates emerged from the movement? So
no, it's much too soon. I don't know if it's even... It has to develop organically. We're still at such an early stage of the process. There has to be a lot of discussion like this and all over the place all the time and a formulation of a kind of general analysis and the analysis which keeps in mind the systemic question. And then if people from within the group who thoroughly embrace that systemic analysis can come forward as candidates and organization to back them, then we could talk about it.
Yeah. Nobody, and I mean, like Michael Moore.
Yeah.
I mean, all kinds of like poverty specialists, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Nobody has come to take the lead.
There are lots of people.
The movement is specifically requesting at this time, and that's through the general consensus, that is not what's wanted and needed yet. And I think people are respecting that. I think that if any of you saw the short clip of John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis in Atlanta, being at the Occupy Atlanta recently, who, in my mind, he is one of the few people that I would look to as a politician. When they decided in the General Assembly to not have him speak because it was not part of the... He very humbly and very graciously left. You know, I mean, I think that... People are trying to honor what's being built here. And yes, I do think that people will emerge. I really think they will,
that's
and I think that they'll emerge stronger than they
so
would have otherwise.
There's a lot
otherwise.
Of criticism, there's no focus, there's all kinds of stuff.
Water over the back, you know?
Can I just ask
a favor in the spirit of community? Would people be willing to just say their first names as they speak? You know, because I might see you again and want to say, hey, how you doing?
My name is Anil.
Anil. Thanks.
My name is Smitty.
I'm Angela.
And I'd like to say that in Massachusetts, we did have Jill Stein, who tried.
She did.
And now we have a woman, Elizabeth Warren, who at least would be much better than Scott Brown. And she seems real. Isn't, you know, so.
But that's always...
But we do need people from a movement. That we, like,
but that's always the problem. It's always what you were saying. The Democrats are going to use the Tea Party to say, look how scary they are, look how horrible they are, and to, you know, to bring us back in there. And every single time any popular movement gets sucked into the Democrat Party, the life gets taken out of it, and it may as well just go in the grave. Because if you think about it, the labor movement of the 1930s, they hitched their star to the Democrat Party, the radicals were purged, and the labor movement was gutted. The anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s, and even against the Iraq War, they hitched their start to the Democrat Party. Again and again, they have served the interests of capital, of empire, and racism. Every time. They are not friends of the working class. That's not to say, as Victor said, that there are not good Democrats, but as an institution, it is utterly corrupt and utterly unreformable, and we need to do something else, something better, and I think we're starting to do it now.
Wonderful. How do we then do that?
We're doing it here.
But if we have no money,
just talk.
Hey, I'm Steve, and I would just like to say that any progress we've made on the left
has only been when a president has no other choice but to react to a popular movement. FDR didn't run on the New Deal. He reacted to a moment like this.
Right.
That, what we, the people on the street defined the New Deal. It wasn't his idea.
Right.
Johnson dragged his feet and was a classical reactionary in racial matters until he reacted to Martin Luther King's sponsorship and the civil rights movement, which started on the street.
Right.
So if we're looking to our leaders to lead, that's not the way it works. It's the people on the street begin a conversation, which can't be ignored, and then the opportunists that they are, the whores that they are, actually grab onto our ideas and say, hey, that's right, that's what I wanted to say all along. It's the only way. The last president that was afraid of us was Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And I was there in the 70s, and Lyndon Johnson too. We drove Lyndon Johnson from office. He got on the television one night and said, I will not run or accept the second term. And that's because people on the street made him pay the price for war. And it was only this conversation, people on the street, jumping up and down and making total nuisances of ourselves and doing the best we can, that we know they're going to try to hijack this movement. The question is, what movement are they going to hijack? So we got to have our homework done when they do stand in front. And we point to them and say, yeah, you can be the leader for now. But the Tea Party had some success because they hijacked the Republican Party. If we, there's only two flavors. You can have any flavor you want, as long as there's chocolate or vanilla in America. You only get two, Democrats and the Republicans,
like,
and that sucks. And that sucks. So we wanted to hijack our democracy, which we can take back. We can take back that party.
I'd just like to comment briefly on an excellent statement. Do our homework. That means not just occasional talks like this, but studying, study groups, discussion groups, a constant thing. I mean, one thing I didn't mention that's also a part of the present crisis that wasn't there in the 1930s is the environmental crisis, which has created a tremendous level of urgency and which isn't discussed, because that involves discussions of how we all have to reorganize the society in order to not have to use as much energy, for example.
You know, I had one question.
Someone who hasn't spoken yet.
Yeah, you had your hand up.
I was just saying that.
Speak up.
Yeah, sure. My name's Ryan, and I was thinking that this idea that we only ever have two parties to compromise between, I think this party politics died a death just recently.
Yeah.
When people are polled who they'll vote for when it comes to a presidential candidate, 50% of them say they'll consider voting independent. That's a dramatic exponential increase over any polls during our lifetime. And that's respective of people's consideration of a policy direction. So we can create a choice through our conversations.
Fuck you, party.
In that sense, that's something that I wanted to speak to. Again, I'm Angela, and about the whole thing about learning our history, one of the things that I'm hoping to be able to contribute to this movement is some of my experience going through several of, you know, movements and what we learned from each of them. And right here in this town, in fact, we have a beautiful example of the Rainbow Party. You know, the folks who built that Rainbow Party, it endured for almost 20 years, and candidates were elected behind that. It was a very independent, I mean, you know, and it wasn't national, well, it was actually, if you think of Jesse Jackson and all that. But aside from party politics, one of the things that I did about learning more for myself is that I'm like, who are the voices that we're not hearing yet about what could happen? And there are a group of African-American female women, economists, who have been writing for years and years about what they see can happen. And I actually wrote them. I knew some of them, but I knew I wouldn't remember it. And I just want to just, you know, so maybe if you'll go back and Google them, that'd be great. And right here in this town, she's actually a white woman, Randy Albelda, a good friend of mine from long, long ago. She's here local. She knows what she's talking about in terms of building something different. But some of the women of color, Dr. Margaret Sims, she is a vice president at one of the most progressive black or African-American think tanks. And she is the vice president at the Joint Center for Political, I mean, you know, these things aren't as important. But she has written extensively about what can happen to address perpetual poverty in this country. And, you know, beyond just the rhetoric, she's really talking about practical measures. Julianne Malveaux, a woman named Rhonda M. Williams, she was somebody I did not know, and she's part of something called a sister circle, Black Women in Work Collective. If you Google these people, and I'll be glad to give you this, you know, there's stuff online about what they're saying would make a difference. And I really am hoping that we can reach just a little beyond what our common understanding and information is this time and include some of these voices as well. And loved hearing yours.
Thank you, Angela.
Thank you.
So any other questions, observations, comments, suggestions?
Everybody calls Massachusetts a blue state. I'm Steve. We're not really a blue state. The largest party in Massachusetts is unenrolled, also known as independent. There are more independent voters in Massachusetts than any other party. And there are maybe seven or eight states where that's true. So we do have the groundwork for the conversation where, but the real challenge will be to move any of the Republicans our way. So to be an independent doesn't really mean anything. It just means that you're, that you don't fit neatly into the Democratic box, and you're totally frustrated with the other side. So I just want to point that out, that a third party is the reason, I think Clinton got elected, right, with Ross Perot? That's the reason that there was somebody, and it's how Bush carried Florida with the third party, with the third vote. And it always sends the fracture.
That's disputable.
Right.
Yeah, right. Well, if you discount all the thievery,
But
it's only when there's another voice. A third voice seems to just sow the seeds of a lot of bad stuff for anybody trying to make a change.
Well, yeah. See, that's why the whole electoral effort has to be entered very cautiously. I mean, there's an important aspect of our movement now, which is called the Democracy Movement, which is centered actually in Madison, Wisconsin. And, of course, one of the things that they're trying to popularize is the idea that this simple majority, single ballot system is undemocratic on its face, and it discriminates against other candidates. And if you have instant runoff voting, you can vote in your order of preference. And so if your preferred candidate gets in, does not get in, then at least your second choice gets another vote.
Right.
So this is part of political education, is talking about different mechanisms. Although I think the basic aspect of political education is discussing the class structures of the society and the basic underlying economic interests. But these mechanisms are important because we do want to ultimately present a kind of positive alternative.
But I think also, if we're talking about political education or forming independent parties, to what end? Are we merely seeking to reform it so that the 1% don't rob us as much as they do now? Are we merely seeking it to make sure that the banks are maybe slightly more regulated, but they're still functioning, they're still getting rich off of the labor of people here? Or are we actually going to try and make it do like what Bertolt Brecht called the simple thing, but it's so hard to do, and that is to put a system where people ultimately become before profits, where all our needs are provided for? I don't think it's quite that radical that everyone has a right to health care, to an education, that no one should be foreclosed, no one should lose their home, that everyone has the right to freely develop their personality. And why are we engaged in these wars that do not serve anyone's interests here, but only serve the interests of those people up there, of the ruling elite, and of these ruling parties? So if we are going to get involved in politics, to what end? Merely to reform this system or to build a new one? And you could call it socialism, communism, anarchism, or something else, but to what end to enter politics? Merely to make the system run better or to put a new one that actually does serve popular needs in the working class?
Excuse me, may I interrupt you just for a moment? Mic check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
Facilitation group is meeting over there right now. We need some more people. You do not have to be experienced, but we need you now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I think on the long-term level, I agree entirely. But in the short term, you can't avoid these politics. And by demanding the
the whole thing, we create a movement which to which those in power will respond, as in the case of the New Deal, by doing little bits of it, which do improve people's lives somewhat, and also by so doing, add credit to our movement in the sense that if people can see positive immediate results as a result of the presence of a force that's asking for much more, they will rally to our cause and bring others as well. So, the two
questions I'm not counterposing reform to revolution or something. I speak very much like Rosa Luxemburg, the great German revolutionary, who said, "Reform. We struggle for reforms," and she was a revolutionary. She was admitted of this. But she said, reforms to educate people, to get people involved in the struggle, because when you're out there leafleting, balloting, doing what we're doing here, holding signs, you are getting an education. But ultimately, those reforms are not going to change the systemic nature of the basic system, that ultimately it's going to have to be the working class and popular movements that do have to take power to put a new system in its place.
Thomas
Jefferson.
What sort of steps do you think we can take specifically as an individual to sort of promote this idea of a third party or reform aside from our vote?
What steps can we take as individuals? I would say that the first thing always is to become better informed, to use the alternative media, and then to talk to all your friends and associates and colleagues, whatever, everyone, and then to begin to organize them, I mean, to bring them together to discuss the things, and always on the principle that many intelligences coming together are better than one. So that's the first step, and then you as you follow the events and with the analysis of it, you're aware of other things like it being done, you hook up with other people, and that's sort of part of creating a network, and then you may go eventually to conferences. It might be local or national, you might even organize one locally, local, national conferences, where people exchange ideas and network, and then there's all these technological media, which are, as long as they're kept sort of as auxiliary and not the main thing, can be very helpful as well. So, I mean, there's no real form. It, in a way, this is something that does have to be rediscovered each time with the people who are there and available and ready to do something. But, I mean, I think those are the first steps, you might say. Sure.
Yeah. You know, one quick thing. If everything is peacefully done, how much leeway do you have with law enforcement system? The law enforcement and legal system are very, very tough. You just go this way and you're in trouble. So,
they're enforcing property rights. But America is all about
the problem.
This is my property, and that's public property.
That's a huge problem. I mean,
that's all they do.
And again, there are lots of different patterns of the way it works out. I think ultimately, the greatest strength we have against it is mobilizing really large numbers. If we mobilize really large numbers, it shifts the balance a little bit. It even makes people who may be involved in that think twice. And I one of the things that impressed me during the Wisconsin occupation of the State House was how the police unions joined in with the protesters. Well, up to a certain point, they could. Eventually, they had to follow their orders. But the immediate attitude that they had was one of sympathy to the occupying people. So, and that's really a revolutionary moment. It is a moment when those sort of forces of order break down. They're no longer willing to carry out the orders. And that happens in different countries at different times. I mean, there have been recent instances in South America like that, where that's been demonstrated. Or when there was an attempt by the elite to overthrow Hugo Chavez, the elected president of Venezuela, in April 2002, the military ultimately split. They were affected by the massive crowds outside, and they rejected the people who sort of carried out the coup and brought him back into power. So, but the presence of huge numbers of people is important, and that requires a level of understanding and involvement much greater than what's normally thought of in terms of just thinking of who to vote for.
Victor, there's an anti-war march at 1 p.m. at the Commons this Saturday. If anyone doesn't know, tell your friends, because we're going to have 10,000 people there, I'm sure.
Great.
And maybe 20.
Yeah. Okay. Sunday. Thank you.
Well, that's a question that goes unanswered a lot. What can I do as an individual? And I'll tell you from my selfish point of view, I'm a union organizer. And when I get a picket line up there and people don't cross the picket line, that's a huge statement. And it's a moment where you are actually doing your part. You're putting one brick in the wall that really helps. Because somebody's going to set a price for your labor. Only union people have any part of those conversations. We're the only ones that ever get to talk about how much our life is worth. You sell your life 1 hour at a time until you die, if you're a wage earner. And you have no power at all over the price you set for your life unless you stick together. Now, this is kind of like a union movement. We're kind of like the pain in the ass union. That's because we don't really have another purpose right now except to get noticed. And that's a good thing. That's a great thing. But somehow, when you get a union together and you confront an employer and put your labor on the table and your right to withhold that labor, that drives a conversation about what your hour is worth, what the price of your labor is worth. Now, if you aren't in a union, you should know. A non-union nurse makes some portion of what a union nurse makes. Now, the nurses were here today. They were among the most militant union people in today's America, all right? They were the building trades used to be. I'm a carpenter organizer. We're weak now, and we're not gaining power. But the nurses, however, are, as the population ages. A union nurse at Brigham and Women's Hospital makes $85 an hour. Okay, that's $160,000 a year. With all her certifications, or his certification, 160 grand. A non-union nurse has to make some portion of that. Otherwise, the union hospitals will get their pick of the best people. So to keep somebody happy, you have to pay them, because somebody has set a price for their life. Somebody has set a price for their labor. That's what unions do. So even if you're not in a union, and that's all the point I'm trying to make, you can support a union and support your right to make a decent wage by supporting people who are fighting that struggle. Sooner or later, the police and firefighters will be out here, even though they're not supposed to strike, because their pensions aren't funded. And as things get tighter and tighter, they're in exactly the same boat everybody else is. They have promises that can't be kept. They have $50,000, $60,000 pensions on the line that they're not going to get because they've never been funded. Okay? Private unions have funded our pensions. My pension is there. It's actually in the bank. Okay? So, support a union when you get a chance. Don't walk by a picket line. And talk to someone who's crossing a picket line. Shame on you. That's the kind of thing that we don't do as a society anymore. And that, like, people, this generation who is running this encampment hasn't seen it happen. We've been bad examples. We screwed it up. And you have to take it back. Sorry about that. You know, we really screwed it up. Union carpenters make $30 an hour. And we got to fight tooth and nail because this guy's driving 3 hours to Boston to work for $12 an hour. So we can be almost twice as good. We can almost justify 24. It's really hard to justify $30 an hour. And that's not even counting our benefits. But we do well. And we do well because of people like Mayor Menino, who insists that unions be respected within the city of Boston. And that if you do a job in Boston, there's a minimum wage connected to it. Not even a union wage. He has all kinds of standards.
What about everybody else's on?
He doesn't respect the space.
If you're not in a union, you should know. If you're a non-union laborer, you make some portion of what a union laborer makes. A union laborer makes around $40.
I get you.
Son of a bitch.
Right now, there isn't enough work. No union is just taking anybody in. But
I do construction, too.
Yeah.
I've been in business for 4 years by myself.
Yeah.
And I'll take $15 an hour.
I know you will.
Right. I'll give him $15.
But you're setting the price for your labor.
Yeah, I'm setting the price, but I'm setting the price for his labor, too.
But you should still be supporting union people who are helping to drive your wages up.
Yeah.
And that's...
You know, me and my guy are all brothers. That's why
that's what unions do.
I don't
even
want to start that talk with you.
I know. Hey, they made it illegal to form unions right now. I mean, you can't have a fair election. It's impossible to form a union right now.
So you don't walk that line. Like, you don't walk over that pick-up. You don't do that. You don't... When they were in the struggle for a fair wage, but when that fair wage becomes so extreme, so much money, and everybody else is nothing. We're not supposed to cross your line. We're not supposed to say no shit. Make more jobs for other guys who are sitting here like this who can carry shit. I can carry shit all day long.
Yep.
But I'm not going to do it for fucking $9 an hour. You know what I mean? Fuck that shit.
No, and the only reason you're not making $3 an hour is because of a conversation about minimum wage and a conversation about prevailing wage.
The only reason why I'm making I'm not making $3 an hour because 4 years ago when I walked out of prison, I said, fuck this. I ain't working for nobody. I ain't giving away my labor to anybody. I ain't giving away my power. I'm keeping my power.
That's the model. You made your own market. Congratulations.
Yes.
If you can navigate that.
You can't do that anywhere else. You can do that here in America. You can do that right now. Just be creative.
Or you can do it in construction.
I can do
pretty hard to start a bank.
You know what I mean? Like, give me some money and see what I can do. You know what I mean? Like, I'll get my own and see what I can do. I'm 28 years old.
Where do you teach?
Berklee College of Music.
Really?
See, that's why I don't come on so much. I'm all pent up and shit.
Yeah. Any other questions? What I'll say is, I'll be glad to be available for any discussion groups that people want to set up where we can talk about particular aspects, go into more of this informally. So I think that might be a good way to continue what we've started here. And I'd encourage you to come to the other lectures in the series on different subjects and to continue being part of this movement and helping it grow.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Yeah.